Welcome to Season 2 of How to Scale, the podcast by Frog Capital focused on helping software companies successfully scale up. In Season 1, we covered a range of topics with our group of operating partners who have learned from years of experience the different challenges all companies face on their way to scale. This is part of Frog's scale-up methodology, which brings together insights and tools to help improve companies' probability of reaching sustainable profitability. My name is Jens Düring. I'm one of the senior partners at Frog Capital. We invest in purpose-driven European software companies in the scale-up phase. In Season 2, myself and my colleagues are interviewing seasoned professionals in our network to share our passion for scaling purpose-driven software companies in Europe.
Welcome to the latest episode of How to Scale. My name is James Bagan. I am one of the operating partners here at Frog Capital, and I am delighted to be here today with somebody I've known for an awfully long time, back from probably your Dun & Bradstreet days, John, back in the 90s.
Yeah, 90s, 2000s.
Yeah, showing our age, the pair of us. And John is somebody that not only I know well, but is a friend of Frog, having worked in GB back in the day. But I'll let John now tell us a little bit about his background and his experiences as a business and sales leader.
Thanks, James. Pleasure to be here. Really good to catch up with you again. Look, my background was, my kind of first proper job was at Dun & Bradstreet. I worked there for quite a long time. Actually, I started as a business analyst, then realized that, I was very good at maths, but I was much better at using those analytical skills in sales. And that will become a theme, analytical skills in sales, because I think that's very, very important to try and use your intellect in how you sell. And with that in mind, I kind of believe that everybody can be a great seller and everybody in a company should be a great seller. From D&B, I went to work for the PE where we nearly became business partners. And I worked for PE Back Business up in Manchester. And from there, I then ended up as group managing director of a company, a public company now called GB Group PLC. We floated that. We took that from a 18 million valuation when we floated up to it was just about £1 billion valuation when I exited. I exited to start my own business called True Narrative, which we grew from nothing to 10 million ARR in about 4 years. It was a technology business. It was a software as a service business. And we sold that to LexisNexis a couple of years ago. So that was my journey. It was quite exciting. And understanding go-to-market was, I guess, my superpower. And that's what helped me a lot in terms of being successful in all of those businesses.
The reason that we're here today is we're going to talk about a couple of what we think might be the key elements in successfully scaling sales teams. And those are process and skills. And you've already alluded to the latter in some of your comments about anybody being able to sell, I guess, with the right support around them. But perhaps we could start with process, because I want to ask you what that word means to you. I certainly, if I roll back 30 years when I was at my desk or on the road, process actually for me was a slightly pejorative term, because I would infer things like micromanagement and control and an admin and perhaps even delay, you know, all sort of anathema to salespeople who are trying to get from A to B as quickly as possible. So when you talk about process, the importance and the value of process, what do you mean?
So all successful businesses have what they would call standard operating procedures. And often salespeople like to pretend there aren't any standard operating procedures. And the reality is there are. It's just that they're very nuanced and they need to be understood and mapped. And all businesses that are successful, from the key top seven technology businesses through to consultancy businesses, through to the large fintechs and the banks, they follow standard operating procedures. So I adopt things called MSOPs, minimum standard operating procedures, in all of my businesses. And whether it's HR, finance, technology, product, marketing, sales, all of those teams, we adopt SOPs, standard operating procedures. And the difference between SOPs and KPIs are that a standard operating procedure is how to. The KPI is what was. And often sales teams, sales leaders, sales managers, even CEOs don't really understand the difference. And the idea is that by ensuring that process is driven by standard operating procedures, you know that a minimum level of achievement will be arrived at. So a standard operating procedure might be, for instance, about how we go to market. It might be about how we sequence our emails. If you've got an MQL and an SQL, they're the same thing. They become joined, and there is a process that drives one to the other. And what that ensures is that sales are driven by marketing. And what it ensures is that a good understanding of new business and a good communication with existing customers is achieved. And then how sales, new business, and account management then react to that information is then another standard operating procedure. Now, that's not meant to constrain people. Okay, what it means is that you have a minimum way that you do something. Of course, you can excel. Of course, you can do more. But there is a minimum, which means that, for instance, we know that in account management, if you sign up a new piece of business, and if you want to keep that business for 3 to 4 years, and it's on a 12-month contract, the first 90 days are the most important 90 days. So rather than have this, we'll just do anything for them and make that an unprofitable account, understand what the touch points are, detail those touch points, ensure that they're built into CRM, ensure that there is a process of quality engagement. And that can be put into a standard operating procedure so that everybody does the minimum. Now, so that's what should happen in every department. And so there is a process of putting that in place. But it has to be quite detailed. And I always talk about, success is boring. And what I mean by that is success is boring because it's detailed. You can't wing things. So a standard operating procedure, as an example, might be that you prepare before a meeting. And these are the key things that you should look at. It might be that you follow up a meeting within 5 hours with the minutes of that meeting. It might be that all proposals are sent via the CRM so that you can see who looks at the proposal, when they look at it, how much they look at it, what time they spend on each page, rather than send a proposal attached to a standard email, rather than send pricing just in a single document. So process isn't about how many calls did you do today. It's about the quality of what you do so that we can then take a whole team to market. And that's about success of a business. It's not just about the ego of one salesperson.
How do these minimum operating procedures come to be in your businesses? How are they crystallized? Is somebody commissioned to map all of this out and then create some kind of playbook?
Yeah, so that's exactly what happens. Right. So you create a playbook. So the idea is that the chief revenue officer, in conjunction with her or his team, will produce a playbook that maps out every area, usually chief revenue officer, because it would also, and it should include marketing, because marketing's key task really is demand generation. In larger businesses, there's brand awareness, completely agree. But in smaller businesses, and when I say smaller, perhaps 100 million and below of revenue, it's demand generation. In B2B businesses, clearly in B2C is completely different. So marketing and sales should be completely joined at the hip. They should be completely focused on the same thing. So the chief revenue officer should produce that playbook in conjunction with sales and marketing as a go-to-market theme, and then detail what everything, what all of those standard operation procedures are. That isn't their targets. That isn't their KPIs. That's something completely different.
Yes.
That's how you measure the success. But if you get standard operating procedures right and they're being followed, then if we're not hitting our numbers, we know it probably isn't sales effectiveness. If that's being achieved in the first place, it probably isn't sales effectiveness. It could be market fit. It could be the way we talk about ourselves. It could be our pricing. Okay, it could be other things. And these are important things to understand, because if you just always say, it's the sales team's fault, let's change the sales manager, that's just too simple, and it's wrong. And that's why sales leaders, that's why revenue leaders should embrace standard operating procedures. Because when you know you do it right, it will be something else that's wrong. And it points you to where that delta is so that you can fix it as a business and as a CEO and as a board of that company. An example. Often in SaaS and DaaS, I'm told that we're driving demos. And I kind of, this first like big sign that that company's probably going to fail in my eyes when they're just driving demos. Because demos don't create customers. Value creates customers. Our needs create customers. And so what they should be driving towards always is fact find, and finding out and discovery of what the challenges are of the prospect or the customer they're talking to. And then a demo isn't a demo, it's a proof of concept. So changing those behaviors and understanding what you're doing in sales, and kind of moving on to skills here, really, James, is really important. But actually, standard operating procedures can help you understand that better. So I often hear people say, well, the sales process we follow is MEDIC. And I say, well, that's not a sales process. That's a way of measuring how effective your sales process is. It isn't a sales process. And so MEDIC is a way of understanding the each play within within a sale. So it's the metrics, it's the economic buyer, it's the decision criteria, decision process, identifying pain, and who's the champion. Is that important? Yes, but just because you know it hasn't or has been done as a process. So this is a great example of KPIs dictating a process. So that doesn't help you change anything. But a standard operating procedure would be, how do you identify the economic buyer? How do you identify the pain? The pain being the most important thing. How do you identify the bridge between where you are and what you have and how that solves the pain? How do you widen the gap between what they think the pain is and what it needs to be for the ROI of your product? So all of these things can be put into a standard process within a sales playbook, which means that they can be taught to anybody, which means they can be adopted. And great, great salespeople probably already do that. They just don't know why they do it. It's a bit like looking at a great boxer or a great athlete. They might not know why, but all the greats in any sport always have great coaches who understand how to break down their performance into micro parts and coach them on it. And that's what good businesses do. They break down great performance into those micro parts. They become the operating procedures, okay? And that's what you then coach people on. And that's why a playbook is so important. So you're right. An MSOP is effectively a playbook.
I actually couldn't agree more. I think the misnomer, the mistagging of MEDIC as a sales process is at least an amber flag for me. It definitely feels like somebody hasn't fully understood what it's there for. For me, it's a qualification methodology. And I know that's true, because you can swap the qualification methodologies out of the processes, can't you? You can have Correct. MEDIC, or you can have Challenge, or you can have SPICE, or you can have, if you're still stuck in the 60s, SPIN or BANT. But you know, you can lift and shift those, but still have a a standard process. But you mentioned something there that I just wanted to focus in on, and that's the criticality of discovery. How do you teach, how do you enforce high quality discovery?
So I giggled in my head when you said in the 70s with spin. So I actually think the simplest thing to teach people, which then bright people can then advance, is Huthwaite spin. Because it simplifies the questioning process. What it doesn't do is
Let me just stop you. So let's look test for me. So situation
problem implication need. So yeah. Well, actually, they kind of advance it. So situation problem implication need payoff. And the idea is it really helps you understand what questions you should be asking. And so what I always do when I'm training salespeople, especially junior salespeople, but often even senior salespeople, is keep asking situation questions. You need to understand more and more and more. And then spin then breaks down into, when you get into complex sales, it breaks down into high gain and low gain questions. So a high gain question is something that makes the person that you're talking to think about the answer. So when somebody thinks about an answer, it means that they internalize the answer. That's just straightforward neuro-linguistic programming questioning, right? So if somebody has to think about something, they'll understand what they're thinking about. So a high gain question gets them to think about what they're going to say back to you. It's not just that they can't, it's not the same as a closed question.
No.
So a low gain situation question might be, I need to know, if I'm selling you software for HR, I might need to know how big and how many employees you've got. Okay. Now, without knowing that, I don't know what modules are going to be right for you. So I've got to ask, but it's low gain because they know the answer. Okay. So it's high gain for me, low gain for you. As the customer, a different way of asking might be, talk to me about the growth of the employees and where you see it going. Try not to ask two questions in one go like that, yeah. But that would be a high gain question. Because another way of asking that would be, can you explain how you're going to grow the people within the business over the next 3 to 5 years? And then you can throw in a low gain from what to what. And that's how you get your facts.
Right.
But the person's thinking about how, not what.
Yeah.
So questioning skills at discovery are just so important. And some people are just really good at it.
They
just naturally think that way. They're intuitive. They have a high level of intellect. They want to ask lots of questions. You meet these people all the time. And they tend to be really good at those situation questions. You then move on to the problem, and the bridge is the implication. So what does it mean if? And so in other words, if you don't do it, and then the need payoff. So spin is relatively simple to teach people. It can be taught to somebody within 6 months, 12 months of them moving into a sales role. But what you often find is that people can't do it after 10 years in sales roles because they've never been taught.
You're advocating the simplicity of it.
I would say that should be part of your standard operating procedure.
Yeah.
All sales should be trained regularly. And although I believe spin is the simplest way of doing it, you then advance and teach them things like Challenger. But I would never teach, and I would never put that into a standard operating procedure, because it's so dangerous for people that don't know how to use it.
Yeah.
Challenger selling is really something that very, very experienced, very bright people can do. But it isn't something that I would expect a salesperson to do.
And it carries some risk as well.
It's a massive amount of risk.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've lost deals because I use Challenger sales.
As have I.
Yeah. So, but it's how you win some of the biggest deals. So you do need to learn it if you're in high value sales.
Just a quick question then on that, John. So is it possible as well for one organization to have two different approaches, perhaps based on different market segments.
Yes.
So if you've got this team over here, you know what I mean? There's got a team over here doing the sort of high volume, low value stuff, and then the team over here doing enterprise deals. So that'd be a slightly, or maybe a very different approach.
I completely agree.
Okay.
So I guess what I'm advocating is that there should be a playbook. It should be between sales and marketing. It should be a standard operating procedure. There should be skills and competencies baked into that, and at what level. All sales and marketing people should be trained regularly so they understand how to talk about their products. So we did some great training actually here at Frog, and it talks about how you join when you do a proof of concept or a demo, how you join the spin, situation, problem, inclination, need, payoff, and how you bridge that to a demo by using feature advantage benefit. Yeah. And it was genius.
Was it?
You hosted the session.
Thank you.
Yeah, I knew you'd play it down. And it was absolutely genius because it is the classic way. And it was about 3 or 4 years ago. And I was looking for a way of how you take a demo or a proof of concept and build it into your fact find and into your discovery. And that became my standard operating procedure.
You're welcome.
I didn't pay for it either. I got it free.
Quite right. This point about skills, and I loved what you said in your preamble about, you know, everybody can sell with the right, the right support, right educational environment around them. But looking through the sales lens, John, where do you stand on this sort of nature versus nurture argument? What are your thoughts on this for salespeople?
It's nurture.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's nurture. I was a maths geek at school, high functioning maths capable, as are two of my sons. But the environment that you grow up in, I was very, very lucky. I'm a massive believer in the 10,000 hours. And you know, my mother was a sales director. She became global head of training for a large corporate. And I probably did every single sales training session by the time I was 16 that she'd ever written. And I was able to call her every single week when I was a sales leader. And I was a sales leader when I was 26. And ask her about problems and ask her about deals. And I believe that if you've got the right leadership around you, the people that have been trained and you are trained, you will become really good at sales. I think that there are people who are naturally outgoing, but I don't think naturally outgoing makes you a good salesperson. It possibly does down the market, you know, when you're trying to distinguish between the guy next door who's selling blankets to the person who's selling pressure cookers. But that's not the world we're in. We're in B2B sales. What you do in your fact find, what you do in your bridge to their needs and your product, what you do in your proof of concept, what you do in your proposal, the way you write your executive summary, the way you build your ROI and how you show that ROI, the way you build your internal rate of return for them so that you put your expenditure over and above anything else they were going to invest in, the way that you then make that simple in terms of pricing, the way that you then follow up and find out who your coach is, who the economic buyer, that all takes intellect. It all takes process. It all takes understanding of people. It's complex. Selling is a profession and it's very detailed and one of the most detailed professions that there is. So to do it really well, you have to learn it, which means you can be taught it. Having an outgoing personality, is useful potentially if you want to stand up in front of people and present, but presenting is a very, very, very small part of sales. There's so much more involved. So I believe nurture is the most important thing.
Well, I think that's a wonderful point to finish on. John, it's been an absolute pleasure listening to you today. I think there's some really interesting takeaways. I just want to thank you once again for coming back to see us today and talk about this. And I look forward to the next one.
Yeah, thanks, James. Appreciate it.
thank you for listening. We welcome all feedback, questions, or topic suggestions for us to cover in future episodes. So please email howtoscale@frogcapital.com. And finally, to make sure you don't miss any future episodes, sign up for the podcast at frogcapital.com/podcast. Prog invests in purpose-driven European software scale-ups, making a positive impact on society. We look for businesses who have reached product market fit and are generating over 3 million euros of annual recurring revenue, what we see as a characteristic of the scale-up phase. It's a stage where businesses are continuing the path of positive growth, purpose-driven route to sustainability and profitability. Our own purpose is to help scale the most exciting purpose-driven software companies in Europe. We do this with both capital and our in-house team of operating partners who work closely with all the companies we invest in to overcome the inevitable challenges scale-ups face.